My name is Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Everybody. This is one of those nights where what I'd really like to be doing is sitting down there listening. I'm so laid back, I just may be on something. You know, when I'm this laid back, I'm either having a stroke or something's happening, because I'm just not laid back. But tonight I am, and I'm sure it had something to do with just being here with y'all. Anytime I get south of the Mason-Dixon line, I really feel comfortable. I've been blessed to go all over the country, and I was talking to someone I've come to love and respect a lot today, and talking about I may cut back some of the stuff. I'm not sure what I need to be in California for, or Minnesota, or New England. There may be a reason, I don't know. But where I really feel the most comfortable is in the Southeast, and I'm sure there are a number of reasons. When I'm here, redneck jokes that we think are funny, we know they're true, but we think they're funny. And hell, up there in the north, they don't think they're funny, but they still think they're true, you know. So I really enjoy being here because of that. It's always nice to be able to say the Lord's Prayer and finish at the same time. I've always enjoyed that. And down here, we do that. I mean, when you're up north sometimes, one night I started praying as fast as I could, and I finished 2nd, 6th, 8th, and 10th on the Lord's Prayer that night. And it was an incredible event. Catholics do that a lot. Baptists just pray fast. No, Catholics pray fast, and Baptists just draw it out. You know, I was born and raised a Baptist, and we just draw it out. We sing hymns while we're doing the Lord's Prayer, and I just enjoy being down here when we do that. That's the kind of mood I'm in tonight. I have no idea what I'm going to say. Well, I have some idea what I'm going to say. Many of y'all have heard my talk, and there'll be a lot of that which will be the same thing. But I'm in one of those periods of growth. You know, this whole program of recovery, at least as I've learned over my 21 years, is that there are theories and different plateaus of surrender. And that's why it's really important for, certainly this talk is for the newcomer, but it's also for all the other people in recovery, because I guarantee you this delusional disease of alcoholism shows no respect for age or length of time of recovery. In fact, it even gets more subtle with the longer the length of time of recovery. So I'm in one of those plateaus of surrender deal, you know, where you go along and everything's wonderful, and you put a red ribbon around, hit a wall, and go up the steps, literally and figuratively, in another plateau, and that's the way recovery has been for me. I'm in the middle of one of those. I'm not scared of this one, but I'm fascinated by it. It's kind of like playing with a pit bull, you know. Probably should have a little bit more fear, but I don't have a lot of fear about much of anything anymore except me, and y'all give me a lot of tools to deal with that. I really do appreciate being asked to be here. Appreciate Bob and Ruby picking us up. That's been a lot of fun. And a lot of the other people that I've come to know and love over the years, that's been a lot of fun. Appreciate the fruit basket. Always do appreciate fruit basket. I don't know why they just don't give me a box of candy, because all I read out of the damn thing is the candy. Fruit's too healthy, and I can't possibly consider living long enough to eat the damn fruit. I just eat the candy. I wish I ate the fruit. My doctor wishes I ate the fruit, but I eat the candy. So I'm really grateful for the candy in the fruit basket. And I really do. I really appreciate the speakers. It's been a delightful time for me with the speakers. I mean, it just has been. And this afternoon, you're just going to have to lighten up. You're just not having enough fun with that Al-Anon talk, you know. And I was tired after this afternoon. I went up there and went to bed and watched that thing and just fell off the bed laughing 2 or 3 times. It was wonderful. It was really a spark of just incredible. And for those of you that Richard didn't piss off today, I'll finish it for him. So. I really did enjoy that. I enjoyed all the speakers. And Sheila, I enjoyed you. Because I didn't know your daddy, but I knew your stepmother. I just knew your daddy by reputation. But I think the reason I love you so much is because of Libby. And when you're talking, I just see Libby. You know, not that I parallel your program. Libby's my daughter. I don't intend to be at all. It's just what I really relate to, and it's just that thing. And I think one of the reasons you felt the way you felt about me is because you see a lot of similarities between me and your dad. And when you were talking last night, I really did realize I react just like him. I mean, just exactly like him. I mean, exactly like him. And the kids have learned to appreciate it. It really is my fear and love of both my children. And I do a better job about letting them go, but I'm always looking at their headlights and always looking at things like that, you know. So Daddy did that with me. But all the speakers I really have enjoyed. I laid on the bed last night and listened to a young man talk at 11 o'clock. I get damned old. I have to go to bed early. That sounds like, oh, poor me. You're right. I am feeling sorry for myself, damn it. I liked it better when I was 25. 62 just sucks. But, you know, And you know, so I said, well, if you had some gratitude, feel your gratitude, just to see for yourself. I am grateful, but I'm a lot more grateful at this degree, you know. It really is delightful to be here. I really have a lot of reasons to be grateful. I'm just playing around, and those of you who come to know me know I do play around a lot. I'm deadly serious, but Big Dick talks about that. I really do have a lot of fun from time to time, especially from the podium. I don't think I'm a spotlight hog. I really don't think so, but I really am very comfortable talking to people. I always have been, and I've always been comfortable talking to crowds. And today I've got something to say. I talked for 10 years on the subject when I didn't have shit to say, but I said it anyway. And it entertained a lot of people, you know, and there's some people still listen to my tape. And I told some of the best stories I've ever told. They were Father Martin and Clancy and Sandy Beach. They weren't my stories. They were great stories. And I've got my own story. And it's not nearly as exciting, but it's mine, you know, for whatever it's worth. And today I just play around with it a lot. But I'm deadly serious about the message. And I do agree about the only thing we have that returns, the thing that comes the quickest are our opinions. And a lot of the things I will say tonight are my opinions, but they're based on an awful lot of experience, both inside me and working up to my neck and up to my ears in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know that I'm... Let me say this. There's a lot of things we have to learn and a lot of things we have to relearn. And we really do need to really be real clear about what got us here. And I'm not talking about a sponsor who may be like the emperor's cat who heard from his sponsor, some real bullshit. And when it got down here, it may have worked beautifully, but some of it's therapy and some of it's been diluted. Some of it's... The real strong sponsors are really well grounded in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I spent 10 years outside of it, and I'll talk about that. So I really do have a lot to be grateful for today, and I really am grateful for the majority of it. We have our first grandbaby, and she's now 14 months old. And when Libby had this baby, and of course, as some of you weren't here, my daughter's been in AA 17 years, and I got a son's been in AA 13, 14 years. Both these kids were screaming drunk and drug addicts in their early teens. And the fact is that they're alive because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have a family because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we're conversing with a common language. And it's not just the language of the heart, it's that too, the feelings, but there are rules and principles for living, and we're able to discuss them that way, and they've really been very, very rewarding. And I'm aware of 6 generations of my family. I go to my great-great-grandmother, or my great-grandmother, and then down to this grandchild. And this is the first baby who's had an opportunity to live in a home that isn't either dominated by active alcoholism or dominated by the disease of alcoholism without drinking. This is the first baby who's had a chance to grow up in that kind of environment. Both her parents are alcoholics, which means her chances of being alcoholic are about 95%. And when I went out to see her after she was born, I'm sitting there looking at her in this little crib or whatever babies are in a bassinet. And I'm sitting there looking at this child. Most grandparents think about, you know, Mississippi State or University of Kentucky or U of L or Harvard or Yale or Princeton. And I'm looking at this grandbaby thinking about Hazleton, Betty Ford, and what you hunger, you know. As I said, I'd just like to get my daughter to give her whiskey in her drink, in her milk right now, so we can get her into treatment and get her on in here because she's coming. That's the salary too. And I'm really concerned. I have a real significant concern. Don't get me wrong. I have a great deal of faith. I have a great deal of faith, as I said today, and some of you weren't here, that if you want to get goosed by the Holy Ghost, you have to get off your ass. And there are 2 components of spirituality that Bill Wilson talked about. One is humility, and he said this program is spiritual, and there are 2 components of spirituality. One is humility, and the other is responsibility. And I'm really concerned about the responsibility that we have for the message that my granddaughter will hear. What is she going to hear? And it's really time for us as individual groups and as individuals and as conferences to begin to ask ourselves, what is the message? I will tell you, it's not necessarily the message that comes from the podium of a circuit speaker, because you can hear some real shit from this podium. You may hear it tonight. You know, you may hear it tonight, but you really can. And the salvation of AA is not in conferences, and it's not in an AA circuit speaker. It's the principles that got us here and the recording of those principles, and that's the message that will save us or will destroy us if we don't hear it. And I'm telling you, when I finish, you'll understand I have a reason to say it, because that was my experience, not just my opinion. So I really am concerned and feel the responsibility to say the newcomer may be the most important person in the room, or certainly an important person in the room, because they are the history or they are the future of AA. But the old-timer has the responsibility for the message that that newcomer is going to hear. And we have had many drains and many challenges to the principles that got us here and that are recorded to follow. I grew up in a little town in western Kentucky named Mayfield. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol, no drugs. My grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail. And my home was absolutely commandeered by an adult child of an alcoholic. And it's irrelevant to me what you think of that term. All you have to do is go read the family afterward, and on the first page of the family afterward, it's real clear about the fact that if you're around one of us, you get neurotic. Now, Wilson, God forbid, he used a psychiatric term, and we know psychiatrists suck eggs and chase rabbits, so we ought not to even use it. But the bottom line is they not all of them do suck eggs and chase rabbits. Just the dumb ones do. And so we teach them not to be dumb. But he used a psychiatric term. Now, my mother was neurotic, but I just always called her Goofy, and Mama was Goofy. Mama was Goofy because she was rabid. She was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. And we had an interesting way of treating alcoholics in the 30s in Mayfield, Kentucky, a little town in western Kentucky. When my granddaddy got drunk, they put him in jail. When he sobered up, they put him in a chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. And my mother used to walk past her daddy at least once a week in a chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. The scarlet letter for my mother was not adultery. It was alcoholism. And that dominated our home. It led to many, many strange messages. Because mother's whole alter ego was in her boys, me and my brother. And she lived through us. And so we became perfect real quick to satisfy mama and then to satisfy ourselves. Because we had this disease of alcoholism a long way, as Richard talked about, and all of the feelings that went with it. Drinking was no problem for me in high school. I occasionally would have a bottle of some malt liquor at that time. I've forgotten what it was, Country Club, I think, or something like that. And we'd go out sometimes on Friday night and drink a bottle of beer, and then we'd go sing gospel songs. That's what you did in the 50s in a little town in Western Africa. You drank a bottle of beer and sang gospel songs. And it was clean. It was fun. It didn't happen very often. Then we'd go play Monopoly, and we weren't drunk, you know, and one bottle of beer was plenty. Drinking was no problem for me in college. Occasionally I would drink, occasionally I would get drunk, but it was no problem. It really was not a problem. I started medical school at the University of Louisville in 1958. And everybody took amphetamine to study. And I took it like everybody else, only I was hooked on it immediately. I mean, like that. Everybody else quit taking the amphetamine. I did not. 2 weeks before graduation, my senior year, 1962, I was kicked out of medical school. In an amphetamine rage, I hit one of my medicine professors. They took me to the head department of psychiatry. Dr. Keller said, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "I take too many drugs." He said, "Do you believe that?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "We can help you." And I said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "We're going to put you in intensive psychiatric therapy." So they put me in intensive psychiatric therapy for almost 2 years. I didn't take any drugs. And I learned a whole bunch of things that really did help me when I got to y'all to be able to take and to be able to appreciate the feelings that the fourth step talks about. The fourth step talks about feelings. And I was able to appreciate, identify those feelings and put them in that structure of a good fourth step. And it came a lot easier for me. But going to a psychiatrist didn't keep me off of drugs. I didn't take them. But as soon as I got back into medical school, within 30 minutes, I was strung out on amphetamine again. I didn't know why. I just sat on the steps and cried. Because I didn't know why. Now, you and I both know today why. Because they brought me a lot of knowledge. But they didn't bring me a spiritual solution. And a lot of knowledge, you know what the big book's clear about on that, and my experience is equally clear, I just won't cut it. I'd rather be stupid and be spiritual than smarter than hell and never have any spiritual ability to deal with myself and with my God. So I didn't have that. That year, my classmates enabled me. When I'd get too burned up, they'd take me home. I was married, had one small child. Libby was born at that time. They'd take me home. My wife would put me to bed and call them and tell them I had the flu, and she'd cool me off for a couple days. Hell, they knew better. Some of them are still alive and told me, said, "Burns, we knew what you were doing, but we just knew one day you would grow up. You would realize your potential." How many of you alcoholics have heard that? You'll grow up and you'll realize your potential. And they said, when you weren't using, you were a neat guy. When you were using, you were just really a bad person, an a-hole. But we knew, we thought you'd grow up. Graduated in 1964, and between 1964 and 67, I was in Our Lady of Peace, a mental hospital, in Louisville four times. Strapped down, IV fluids, straight jackets, padded cell. I might sell amphetamine 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months, but I always went back to take it. It always put me in a mental hospital. I remember I was fired up on amphetamine in 1967 in a doctor's lounge. and the Vietnam War was raging, and I was sitting there raising hell about all the bad stuff the government was doing with that inequitable war and blah, 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 blah. And somebody said, well, if you don't like it, why don't you join the Army? And I sat there and I thought, well, by God, that's a good idea. And I walked out and got in my car and drove down to Frankfort, Kentucky and joined the Army. Didn't tell anybody, just joined. Came back and told my wife, packed the kids up. We're going to the Army. Called my office the next day and said, shut down the office. I'm not seeing any more patients. See, that's the way I've done all my life. And it's the way I've really come close to it. It's sober. If I don't like the players, I change players. If I don't like the playground, I change the playground. If I don't like the card deck, I get a new card deck. That's me. And that's just about every drunk I've ever had the privilege of working with. If you don't like the game, change the SOB. Start a new one. And that's the way I did. Almost got put in Leavenworth. After a year, the post commander came down and said, are you taking the amphetamine? I said, yes, sir. He said, if you don't quit, we'll put you in Leavenworth. So I quit. Once he explained it to me, I quit, you know. Came home in 1969, got back on the amphetamine, had a great second year in the Army. I taught Sunday school, sang in the choir, played for the officers' football team, and had a wonderful time. My wife hated my guts. She hated my guts from the first day we ever met, and she hated my guts the day we parted. So she was sniffing on my ass, but that didn't bother me because I felt pretty good about that time, and the kids were a joy. And that year was really fun. I came home in 69, got back on amphetamine. I started my practice, had a gallbladder attack. They attributed parts of the amphetamine, put me in the hospital, took out my gallbladder. My internist, who's still my internist, and my surgeon, who's still one of my best friends, sat beside the bed, and they said, Burns, when you take amphetamine, you're not right. When you don't take amphetamine, you're a neat person. Why don't you quit taking the amphetamine? And we held hands and prayed, and that was my last amphetamine, 1969. Now, I'm sure that the prayer had a lot to do with it, but the fact was I was tired of the consequences. And always with amphetamine, if I got tired of the consequences, I could stop. I could always stop if I got tired of the consequences. That wasn't going to be true with alcohol, because I wasn't drinking during that time. Then I started drinking. First 4 years wasn't an alcoholic. They really weren't. I might get drunk. I may have drunk more than most people, normal people, but I didn't set out to get drunk. I didn't set out to stay sober. It just wasn't an issue. Next 3 years of my drinking, I didn't drink as much, didn't drink as often, but every day I knew exactly when my first drink would be. It'd be at 4 o'clock. I'd walk out of my office at 4 o'clock, walk across, I had a huge practice, walk over to 7-Eleven, buy a quart of beer, put it through my legs, drive 25 miles home, drink that beer, walk in my house and get ready to drink my drug of choice, which was scotch and water. And I would sit there and drink enough scotch to get smooth. See, that's all any of us ever remember was the smooth. You know, and we go to a lot of meetings to remember more than the smooth. Oh, hell, I remember I won a trip to the Bahamas on a 75-foot sailboat in 1973. And I remembered that trip. The memory I had of that trip was out on the front end of that boat, whatever you call the front end of the boat, out on that stick out there on the end. And I'm out there with this thing going up and down in the water, and I feel like King Brady. And in a good revelation to my sponsor, he helped me remember the puke as I was going up there, and the puke flying back across my face. But I remember it as an absolute fun time. And he helped me remember the puke, because all I remember was the smooth and the fun, you know? The smooth and the fun. And that's, you know, there'll come a day, y'all know where it's from, in their decision, there'll come a day we'll be unable to bring into our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation of a week or a month ago. We forget. We just forget. Because that's God's second greatest gift, the ability to forget pain. His greatest gift, for me, is Alcoholics Anonymous. For when I walk in and work with you, I am reminded of every bit of the pain and given a solution to deal with it. And lest I forget, and I will forget, and how many 12-step calls have y'all made, and how many people have you dealt with, they forget. And if you're new in this program, you'll forget too. It's a great gift of God with the responsibility for us to go somewhere where we can be reminded and clean it up. And clean it up. Even be grateful for it. Because it took everything it took to get you here tonight, didn't it? It took everything in my life to get me here. Will I not regret the past? There are a lot of you in this room that will say, damn, how can you not regret the past? There'll come a day when you won't. And for me, the reason I don't is because every bit of my past I've used to help somebody for their future. And there are a lot of people today that have been restructured because of God using me to share with them my past so that they don't have to repeat it. It's their call. It's their call. Last year my drinking was addictive. And I drank a quart of whiskey a night. Told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. And had to believe it. And that last 6 months of that year was the worst 6 months of my life. And each day got the worst day of my life until that last day. And Casey and I had met, and we immediately moved in together. The divorce was long and drawn out. And she was God's greatest gift to me. Two real sick people, beaten up by a lot of stuff, and with good hearts, who came together. And she stuck with me during that time, about the only one who hadn't abandoned me. And I understand why. Because I was not a nice person to be around at that time. And she'd gotten up and gone to work that day, and I was sitting in that chair, and I was saying, God, I can't drink and go to work, but I can't get to work today. And that meant I had to cancel my office, and I couldn't do that. And I sat there, and it was over. I couldn't get drunk, because I knew I was powerless over alcohol. Not that I couldn't quit drinking, but I couldn't drink enough to get drunk. I'm real blessed. It quit working for me. And I would drink enough to stop the DTs. I would drink enough to stop the hallucinations. I would drink enough to stop the sweating and the diarrhea, but I couldn't drink enough to stop the committee and the noise. I couldn't live with it. I couldn't live without it. I hated my guts. I hated the lying. I hated the cheating. I had a string of medals down my chest for 12 years in high school where I went to church, never missed Sunday school or church. I was raised in a home that was God-fearing and loving. Goofy, but God-fearing and loving. And I mean, I had a set of values that were absolutely good values, and I had crapped on every one of them. I was hurting the strength. Nobody touched me without walking away bleeding. And I hated my guts. I didn't think there was any hope. I didn't think there was any help because I didn't think there was any help. I had 8.5 years of psychiatric therapy. I'd been deacon in 5 churches. And I didn't think there was any help. And if there's no help, there's no hope. And I said, God, you have to help me. And I knew exactly what I had to do. And the peace was incredible. The only peace I've known greater than the peace that day was the peace that y'all brought to me when I came to know that God loved me just as I am. And I know that for me. I absolutely know that for me. 100%. And if you don't have it yet, stay with us. There'll come a day when you will know that. And that will be the greatest peace you'll ever know. If it travels the same path I travel. But that peace that day, when I knew what to do, was incredible. I walked into my bedroom, loaded my 12-gauge shotgun, and put it in my mouth, and was ready to die. I wanted out. And that was the only way I knew how to quit. I understand suicide. If there's no help, there can be no hope. And if there's no hope, and the pain is that great, why not? And as I taught y'all this afternoon, the instance of suicide in alcoholics is 17% greater than the normal population. And I understand why. We reach that point where we don't think there's any help, and therefore no hope, and we're out of here. And I felt completely at peace with that. I knew that Casey would be better off without me, my patients would be better off without me, my mom and dad would be better off without me, and I got to my kids and I choked. Because I thought, uh-uh. I'd been in private practice at that time about 10 years. No, about 8 years. I'd seen a lot of people then. Dad saw a lot more before I left in 92. But I've seen a number of grown-up kids who had come in to talk to me about their feelings about the suicide of their parents. What was their part in that? How had they failed their parents? And I thought, I can't leave that on my children. And it's amazing that at the moment of complete self-absorption, because that's what suicide is. That's not a punitive, pejorative term. Complete self-absorption for me means I do not see nor can I comprehend a power greater than me. That's complete self-absorption. There is no power greater than me. And at that moment of complete self-absorption, the very principle that has saved every alcoholic's ass that's still alive became alive and well in me, and that was I was able to think of somebody else rather than just me. Richard read today out of a section of the big book that comes from the 8th step, and it's talking about cleaning up the mess. It says, yeah, that's what we're here for, but what we're really here for is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man. Not to be, but to fit ourselves to be of maximum service. Don't try to give away what you ain't got. I did it for years. But to fit ourselves to be of maximum service. So I thought of my children, put the gun down, and the terror came back, and I crawled to the phone, and I called somebody, and I said, please help me. I'll do anything you tell me to do. Anything you tell me to do, I became teachable. Didn't negotiate, didn't manipulate, not at that time, a couple of months, oh, about 8 months later I got back to that shit, but right then I was ready to do anything you tell me to do, you know, anything. Just take my life and run it. You know, when we're doing 12-step work, I think what we need to remember is that for every alcoholic who succeeds in recovery, they reach a crossroad. And that crossroad is when we make a decision. Do I want to live or do I want to die? And when we make that 12-step call, we need to tell that alcoholic that. We need to tell them that. Instead of walking there and saying, it'll get better. Come on, you can tell them that. Hell, I do. I don't go in there and say you're going to lose all your toes and fingers before it gets better, or you're going to, you know, you'll lose everything you got. I don't tell them all that shit. That may happen. But I grab them and I say, you know, I tell them, you want to live, you want to die, you're going to die. Now, you can choose how. You can choose it with a gun in your mouth. You can choose it with your liver on your iliac crest, and you can be yellow as a damn gourd, or you can be puking blood right out of your esophagus. But you're going to die. What do you want to do? If you choose to live, take my hand. I'll give you everything I got. I'll give you everything I got. And then you take me. So he sent me to a place in New York City called Payne Whitney Clinic, and he sent me there because I kept telling him I was depressed, and he'd say, why are you depressed? And I'd say, well, I'm depressed. And he said, yeah, and you drink? Yeah, but I drink because I'm depressed. And he said, no, you're depressed because you drink. I said, no, I drink because I'm depressed. He said, no, you're depressed because you drink. I said, you don't get this shit, do you? I'm depressed because I drink. So he said he couldn't join me, so he sent me up there. You may know Payne Whitney Clinic, but made One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest look like a walk through Central Park. And he sent me there to scare me. He said, I'm sending you to scare you. And on about, my roommate hanged himself. I walked in on about the seventh day, and I wasn't well. And I was looking for him to play ping pong with me. I opened the closet door, and there he was hanging in the closet. And I remember sitting back on the bed looking at him, and all I could think was, I wonder who I'm going to get to play ping pong with me. And I remember sitting there thinking, that's not normal. But that was the best I could think. And I just dropped on my knees and I said, God, there's something bad wrong with me, and I don't think I'm mentally ill. What do you think the deal is? And it was just like this bolt hit me. You're an alcoholic. And with the choices I had, that was a real good diagnosis. I really did welcome it. Because my other choices were pretty much about that time. So I called my psychiatrist and I said, I'm an alcoholic. I don't need to be in this mental hospital. He said, you're right. And they shipped me to Atlanta. And I spent 3 months in a treatment program down there. And I've really been grateful for it. It was a great experience for me. They taught me how to live with my peers. My job for 3 months was to wash the commodes and sweep the floor. And we went out and bought our food together, and I had the little clicker. They gave me the clicker. There were six of us. We ran like little ducks behind each other, going out, and I had the clicker. Here I am, a 41-year-old physician with this clicker, and love my friggin' clicker, you know? They'd say, marshmallows, 36 cents. Marshmallows, 36 cents. And we'd get to the end of the line, they'd say, how much money we got? I'd think, my God, this is my moment, you know? We had $100. And I said, $98.36. And they'd say, yes, we get treats, you know. And if I had 101, I felt like they were going to chastise me, you know. And the way they did it, they made me pick what I had to carry back. Now, y'all may find that, you can see the people who've either done it or had a recovery, they're going, yes. And you can see the people who are real young, they're going, what the hell is that all about, eh? What are we talking about? That's not fun. So I loved my clicker. It was the first sense of responsibility that anybody's ever given me, and I don't know whenever, but I really did enjoy it. I really did enjoy it. I got home after 3 months and went into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, it's what I call the worst of times and the best of times for AA in Louisville, Kentucky in 1977. This is early 1978 when I got home. It was the best of times because the fellowship was indescribably wonderful. I mean, when we came in, we hooked just like that. And there were about eight of us guys who were inseparable. If one went to pee, we all went to pee. And I'm telling you, literally, this is about it. I was absolutely convinced if the first man stopped, all of us would have our nose up the other one's butt in just about 5 minutes because we were right behind each other. I mean, we played golf together. We took our wives to dinner together. We went to someone's house on the weekends on Saturday and Sunday night. It wasn't 30 minutes before and 30 minutes after meeting. We were inseparable. And I feel so bonded to those men, I can't tell you how much I love those men. I mean, some of them are dead, some of them are not dead, most of us are still not close, but boy, they have a special place in my heart. And it was a wonderful time for the fellowship. It was the worst of times in AA because we never even mentioned the big book. When I came into AA in Louisville, Kentucky, the marching orders were don't drink, get a sponsor, tell him what's wrong with you, he'll tell you what to do, and then go save a drunk. They left out that muddled middle. My first fourth step, outside of what you do a family history in a treatment program for, and any of you who are in a treatment program, you're not doing a fourth step in all probability. You're doing a family history and a family tree. But don't confuse that with a fourth step. The first fourth step I did was a 300-question questionnaire that my sponsor got from Hazleton. My second fourth step was a 200 question questionnaire that he made up. I didn't do my first fourth step the way the Big Book outlines it until I was 10 and a half, almost 11 years sober. I mean to tell you, I went to AA meetings. I became a lethal weapon for God. I was everywhere. I mean, they say, here it comes, drink a bottle of beer, it's going to drag your ass off treatment anyway. Here it comes. I mean, I was everywhere. I spread the disease almost like gonorrhea. I mean, I was everywhere. And I got to know that most of those people that I got, they came to our little group, and thank God we got incestuous on one side of town, so we kept the disease in one abscess over here in the East End of Louisville. And all these other people that came in, after a while, they'd go somewhere else. But we stayed together. We were called Raleigh's Raiders. And we thought it was a compliment. I mean, they would see us come in and everybody scattered like ducks off of a pond. I mean, it was incredible. I lived the first 10 years in AA on 3 1/3 step. The first 3 steps and 1/3 of the 12th step. That 1/3 was carry the message. For 10 years I lived on the 3 1/3 step. And I was getting crazier and crazier and crazier. Goofy all along, finally driven to my knees by a series of events, and I'll tell you what they were. And remember, our book says we go back through our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. Now, let me take you back to that home I grew up in to show you what took me to my knees. My mother lived through her boys. I was the first boy who ever went to college. I asked my daddy, I said, Daddy, why did I become a doctor? There were no doctors in our family. He said, I'll tell you why. So when you were born, said, and this is after mother was dead. So when you were born, he said, I walked into the hospital and your mother had you up in her arms, and she looked at me and she said, Hal, that was my daddy. He said, this one's going to be a doctor. And said, when your brother was born, she said, Hal, this one's going to be a lawyer. And my brother is a lawyer. He's also been in LA for 12 years. Probably saved us both in my profession for whatever that's worth. But in any event, that was what mama set us up to be. And when I was perfect, my mama brushed my little butt and parted my little hair and picked up my dirty underwear and fixed me my food. I mean, all I had to do was perform, and I became, as T-Boat said, king baby. It was also what defined for me my relationship with women, because I came to know that a woman's place in my life was to take care of me and make me feel special. Now, I didn't know any of that. Even the therapy didn't teach me that. But that's exactly what the job description for any woman in my life was. Take care of me and make me feel special. And you can well imagine those women who came in my life having sense didn't stay long. But the ones who came in my life, as we say in AA, when the rocks in my head put the holes in hers, we had a ball game. You know, we had a ball game. And I mean to you, I came to love crazy women because that's the ones I could get. It was there, but I could, except for Casey. Casey wasn't crazy. That's why I took to her and we loved each other, because she wasn't crazy. She wasn't crazy. Casey, when I got sober, quit drinking when I did. She went into Al-Anon and stayed there for, we went into 6 years. She heard her story in AA and she quit AA. She came to see me with about 7 years of sobriety, or seven or eight years after we quit drinking. And she said, and she'd been in AA for a couple of years, she said, Burns, I've never loved you more. And she, see, what I developed with Casey was a benevolent dictatorship. I wanted her to have the best clothes in the world, and I bought them for her, but I never asked her what she wanted. I wanted her to have nice cars, and I saw that she got them, but I never asked her what kind of car she wanted. I wanted her to have good vacations, and took her on magnificent vacations, and never asked her where she wanted to go. And we had wonderful sex, I know, because I defined exactly how, when, and everything about how we did, so it must have been wonderful sex. It was for me. And that was the way it was. I mean, hell, it was a perfect relationship. I told her what to do, and she did it. And at 7 years, she came in, she said, I've never loved you more, but I want to start going to my own meeting, and I want to go back to school, and I want to go into therapy. What I heard was, you're leaving me. Now, what I said was, and I didn't even know that, what I said was, please go ahead, I support you. Now, what does a dictator like that, losing his caretaker, do? An alcoholic. We find another caretaker, don't we? An alcoholic. We find another caretaker, don't we? Now, I was working with a woman in my office, a nurse. What do nurses do? The new nurses don't. They don't buy this crap either. But the old nurses used to take care of doctors and make them feel special. And so there was a nurse, and there were 7 doctors. We worked together, and we had a nurse, and that nurse followed us right over, fixed their meals, took care of her patients, did everything. This woman, I'd worked with her for 2 years. She was divorced. And all of a sudden, she became the most incredibly wonderful woman in the world. And I fell in love with her. But I had a problem. I was in love with Casey, and I was in love with this one. Now, I remember sitting, I'm 10 years sober, 52 years old, and I'm sitting here trying to figure out how I can get these two women to agree that we all three could live together. I didn't think it was funny. It made perfect sense to me. I mean, why not? Well, I went to tell my sponsor about all these feelings I had and these conflicts of interest, and he made sure that my wife found out about it. See, I didn't have a program to deal with resentment, did I? I didn't have a program to take personal responsibility. And the one person I put everything into as a personality was my sponsor. And the innocent thing about sponsors, in a way, they're drunks. And they're one drink away from a drunk. And a half a thought away from being crazy. Every single day of the world. And we absolutely have to have sponsors. I do. But I'll tell you, the principles far supersede the personalities. And we're taught that. We're absolutely taught that. About this time, I'm absolutely distraught. And I thought, God, I don't understand. Where do I go? Whom do I trust? And it's, don't ever leave before the miracle. Please don't ever leave before the miracle. It'll always happen. More than once. This little pigeon man came up with 7 months of sobriety and handed me these 8 tapes. And they were Joe and Charlie's tapes of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I listened to those tapes, he said, Burns, listen to these tapes are any good. And as I listened to them, I cried all the way through them because I heard the program I didn't have. I had 11 copies of those tapes made, and there were 12 of us who started a Big Book study. And for the last 11 years of my sobriety, I have been in at least 2 Big Book studies every week. I'm not talking about mental masturbation studies. I'm talking about studies where you really take the book and you do what it says together. We do it with our sponsors, we do it together, and it is incredible. When Richard talked about Bill Wilson's last talk when A.A. Must and Will Change, and those of you who weren't here this afternoon, when Wilson in his last talk, he was too sick to give it, but he talked about 2 things. And he said Bill was ever more convinced that anonymity was critical. And he also said A.A. Must and Will Change. And I called this lady with 50 years sobriety, and I said, has A.A. changed since you came in? She said, yes. Just like that. She said, when I came in, there were at least 4 or 5 old-timers for every newcomer. She said, today there were about 50 or 60 newcomers for every old-timer. She said, we've got people with 1, 2, and 3 years of sobriety sponsoring people. And I don't know about you, but if you're drunk of my type at 1, 2, and 3 years of sobriety, you were lucky to find the right restroom and find your car in the parking lot. And that's physical stuff. And those of you who didn't hear my lecture this afternoon, pick up the tapes and listen to it because you need to understand it. We literally are playing 2 sandwiches short of a picnic for at least 2 years, and sometimes as long as 4 to 5 years. And that's organic. That's organic. That's not emotional. And yet we've got people sponsoring people that have got 1 and 2 or 3 years of sobriety. And I said, is that bad? And she said, it's just a fact. In our community, I'm telling you, this is our community, we still hold the sponsor-pigeon relationship in reverence. At the same time, we know that the best way to get the message to the most people so that they can then begin to move in one-on-one work is through Big Book studies. And I've done them with 18 weeks, I've done them with 16 weeks, I've done them with 3 years. The line item reading the book and talking about what Wilson meant, bringing the whole history behind where Wilson got all of the information. Yeah, he wrote it in one day, the 12 steps. It took him years to assimilate the sources of spiritual information for God to use him. He took a wounded man and taught him, like he taught Moses, like he taught Jesus. Real easy comparison. He taught Bill Wilson. Yeah, it was inspiration based on a whole sea of perspiration. Absolutely, for him to write this incredible stuff. And we study it, bringing that together. And there's a whole new reverence for our foundation that has come into Louisville, Kentucky. And I'm real grateful God chose me to bring a lot of that in there. I'm really grateful that he has. And I take my responsibility seriously in that regard. We laugh a lot, but we show up and we study hard. When I became a student of this book and began, and there's always something new that I read. I just read for myself on the plane last weekend a chapter to the agnostic, incredible chapter. They're all incredible. But as I became a student of this book, I found out some interesting things. First thing I found out is that my problem's not alcohol. Now, if you weren't at my lecture this afternoon, get the tape because there are all sorts of formulas to tell you that if you're an alcoholic of my type, you'll never be able to drink like a normal person. So if you're sitting there thinking, oh, my problem's not alcohol, I bet I can drink again. No, you can't. You can't smoke dope either. You can't use cocaine either. You can't do any of that shit. It just won't work. And so I'm going to save you a lot of heartache. But it's telling you don't do it. But you can't do it. You know, and smoking cigarettes. One day, you're going to have to live up to that one, too. Because it does the same thing to brain chemistry that cocaine and alcohol do. I'm not saying it's the same disease. I'm just saying what it does to the brain. And one day, you're going to have to face it. Do you think I got to preaching? I did for a minute. That's okay. If there weren't preachers and teachers, I'd be drunk and a goat sitting out in the back porch right now. So sometimes I preach and teach a little bit. And I don't apologize for it. I don't use any four-letter words, and I haven't yet. Except for shit. That's okay. And that's not too bad. Newcomers can't do it. You have to have at least 20 years of sobriety to be able to say shit from the podium. That's all right. Problem in alcohol, fifth chapter, fourth step. The bottle is only is a symptom. Alcohol is a symptom. Seventh chapter at the end of it. Bottle is a symbol. Alcohol is not our problem. What did Wilson say our problem was? He said it was our mind. It's the way we think. And as I said this afternoon, if you think we think like normal people, just shelve it. Listen to that tape this afternoon. We don't think like normal people. Now, I'll tell you the joke I gave this afternoon. If you cut, after 25 years of practicing medicine, I saw hundreds and thousands of patients. If they lose, they cry. They have grief. You cut them, they bleed. But when they're sitting at a red light and it turns green and somebody honks, they don't get out and slap the shit out of the person who honked at them. And we do. Or we spend the next 3 weeks beating ourselves up because we didn't. You know, that's the way we are. And it's the way we think. And Wilson believed it so strongly, what did he call it? He called it a peculiar mental twist. And it must be important because he said that's what precedes every relapse. The peculiar mental twist. Have you ever thought about it? If you haven't read it, then read the book. And if you have read the book and haven't thought about it, think about it. Because that's what's going to have some of you relapse, is you don't understand or have not dealt with how you will think. I know it's a problem of acting ourselves into a way of thinking, but it entirely changes our way of thinking. And our way of thinking is weird. My way of thinking is, and I've dealt with thousands of them, it's just weird as mine. You know? Now, let me tell you, I had to look at, what is this peculiar mental twist? How do I think? Okay? There are three components of peculiar mental twist for this alcoholic. The first is being bigger than the rules. Bigger than the rules. You know? Somebody says, by God, there aren't rules in AA, they're just suggestions. Read Silkworth. Said, if these men, and there weren't women around then, but it'll fit for women, if these men follow a few simple rules. When I came in, I was on my hands and knees hoping you had rules and grateful that you did. Being bigger than the rules. I've got 9 points on my driver's license. 3 more points and I walk. And I'm sitting there the other day thinking, why do I have these 9 points on my driver's license? It may have something to do with driving 95 miles an hour in 65 mile an hour speed zones. And it just irritates the hell out of the cops and they pull me over and they give me a ticket. I thought, well, why do I do that? I must be stupid. And I thought, no, you got all kinds of degrees, says you're not stupid. Well, I must be crazy. No, you got all kinds of discharge summaries, says you're not crazy. Then why do I do this? I know why I do it. I do it because I'm Burns Brady. Those rules are made for somebody else. Speed limits are made. Handicapped parking zone. You know, drop in. I'm only going to be there 5 seconds. I know you shouldn't do it, but hell, I can do it. Now I've reached the point, I've recovered enough where that I won't park in them, but I'll circle the block 7 or 8 times dealing with my 11, my 12 steps so I don't park in that. There'll be a spot 8 rows down. So hell no, I won't take that one. I'll just obsessively, compulsively drive around the block, get ready to park in that handicapped parking lot and say, God help me not to park here, go around the block one more time, you know? I'm going to one day get it to where I'll just park in the regular area, you know, without all that crap. Well, bigger than the rules, extrapolate that to how do you begin your morning? If I get up every morning and I begin my morning with the 11th step prayer, just what it says, the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, if I end my day with the 11th step prayer just the way it says, if I act my day out with the 10th step that leads me to all the other steps, it's a good day. Things may not go my way, but it's a good day. And I mean, if I do that, it's that simple. But do I do it every morning? Hell no. And if you tell me you do, you're lying to me in peace, you know? And you know as well as I know, it'll be okay. It'll be so much better if you do it. But I'm bigger than the rules. About a year and a half ago, one Saturday morning, I was in one of my snits. And I'm sure none of y'all have snits, but I was in one of my snits. And I was sitting there in my snit, you know? And Casey had gotten up to go to her Al-Nine meeting, and she pulled her chair up for me. She said, I know I'm going to my Al-Nine meeting, and I shouldn't do it, but I'm just tired of watching you sit around here with your lip down on your navel. She said, Burns, you've just gotten bigger than the program. And I thought, what is wrong with this woman? Hell, I'm a spiritual rocket. I mean, you get on the back of my butt, I'm going to carry you in. We're going to save Louisville. I mean, by God, you know. They build monuments to people like me. What the hell does she mean, you know? What do you mean I'm bigger? What do you mean I'm bigger than the program? She said, you haven't talked to your sponsor in 6 months. And I sat there and I thought, she's right. I hadn't. See, I was 19 years sober then. It was what Richard was talking about today. And I really appreciated your talk. And probably the greatest thing I appreciated was your attitude in delivering your message. Even if no one agreed with, or some people didn't agree with what you had to say, it was the attitude with which you delivered it. An attitude of love. Because there are people who say the same thing in judgment and will point the fingers I'm doing and tell you what you're doing wrong. He was telling it because he really fears failure and fears for each individual and sees with 34 years of experience what's there. And with 19 years of experience, it had gotten diluted for me and I didn't have to talk to a sponsor. I didn't say I don't have to talk to a sponsor. I just didn't. Bigger than the rules. And what did Wilson call that? He called that self-centeredness. Self-centeredness. Second part of the peculiar mental twist is what I call victimization. You're my friggin' problem. If you get your shit together, the world would be fine. Oh, I mean to tell you, absolutely, the person honking the horn behind me, they're assholes. I was born very poor, and I milked that till I almost died drinking. Oh, man, when you're born poor and from the wrong side of a track in a town that doesn't have a track, you are really in trouble, you know? And I remember I used to say, if you'd been born poor like me and had the caddy around to belong to the country club, or if you'd watch those little rich bastards diving in the pool while you're carrying your daddy's bag, if you'd had to work your way through college like I did, if you'd had to work for a car rather than your mom and daddy giving, if you'd had to marry a rich bitch like I married and stay with her for 17 years. I mean, it was a real... I had a heart attack in 1994. Oh, man, it was wonderful. I mean, for the next 2 years, oh, God, I'm just never going to be able to... Next to being a prostate, then they'll have to take it out, and I'll never get another erection, and that's why it'll be... Oh, it was a hell of a deal. I loved it. I walked around down to here. Victimization. I gave an Al-Anon. I gave a talk to an Al-Anon conference up in Tulsa about a year ago. And I was a 9 o'clock AA speaker on Saturday morning, so I went down at 7:30 with a bunch of guys in AA, and we were going to get breakfast, and we went to a cafeteria, and we sat down at the table, and the waitress brought over our juice and our silverware, and then we had to go help ourselves. So she had to set up, and we went over, and I was the first one in line, and went through to get my food, came back and sat down at the table, and everything was gone. And I immediately said what I always say, why did the bitch take my stuff away? And I got up to go get her and realized I'd sit down at the wrong table. Yeah? But it's just the instinct of me is, you screwed me, you know? That's the way it is. Victimization. What did Wilson call that? He called it resentment and self-pity. If you want a word synonymous with self-pity, it's victimization. Victims may not drink. They just never get sober. And the only other people who never get sober are those people who go back to revisit their past and choose to live there. I strongly recommend that you go back and look at it. You live there, you're screwed. You live in victimization, you and I both are screwed. The third part of the peculiar mental twist is what I call the square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. If a square peg won't fit in a round hole, get a bigger hammer and just beat that son of a bitch to death. Just beat it till it fits.
It's kind of like living life the way I used to put my kids' toys together when I was drinking. It started out to be a truck. At the end, the SOB was flying like an airplane. But by God, that's the way it was. And that's what they got. That's what they got. Square peg, round hole. And why in the hell is that necessary? It's absolutely. The number one thing that most people relapse over is the second half of the first step. When the old-timers used to say to me, he got drunk because he needed to go back to the first step, and I'd say, that must mean he's not tired, he doesn't think he's powerless over alcohol. I've come to know that every alcoholic in this room knows you're powerless over alcohol. And a significant number of you will relapse because you never do admit that your life is unmanageable. And even if you admit it, you never change anything you have to do. And let me tell you, that is the crux of successful living, is whether or not I decide, am I going to run my life, or is God going to run my life? And there are days when I will sit there and cry because I don't want God to run my life, because I'm terrified he's going to give me something I don't want. I had a pigeon I worked with, and he said, Burns, I'll do everything God wants me to do, but you think you could talk to him and they're not making me poor? Absolutely, and then we talk about God won't give us more than we can handle, right? Well, I happen to know that, but let me tell you how I can bastardize that. When I was about 1 year sober, I came busting in. I sat down beside my sponsor, who's always told me to get there 30 minutes early, and I sat down right beside Jim, and Jim, when the meeting goes, looked at me and said, what happened? I said, oh, God just thinks I can do more than I can do. I said, I got up at 5 this morning and delivered a baby, and at 6 I had to be there to the staff meeting. At 8 I had to see everybody in the hospital. At 10 I went in and I saw 60 patients today, and after that was over, I had to go back and see the newborn baby and examine that baby. And then I had to go to another staff meeting. I had to go to the other side of town to do a nursing home. He looked at me and he said, Burns, he said, why don't you bring me your appointment book next week? I looked at him, I said, why? He said, I've just never seen God's handwriting, and I don't want to miss it. And under the guise of God giving me more than I can handle, it's me setting up the deal. Because I'm terrified on some days of either not being able to handle what I get, or I'll get what I don't want. Wilson was real clear in the 12th of self-centered fear. Fear of losing what I got or not getting what I want. It's the second half of the first step. Second half of the first step. It's control and fear. And what did Wilson call it? Fear. And the control that comes out of it. So what the peculiar mental curse means is bigger than the rule, self-centered. Victimization, resentment, and self-pity. And control and fear out of square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. That's the peculiar mental twist in daily living for this drunk. And it's the peculiar mental twist in most drunks that I've been given the privilege to work with. It'll be the peculiar mental twist in you, because you will impale yourself on that. And our book is real clear in how to deal with it, isn't it? Real clear. Sometimes it evades rocket scientists like me who can screw up a one-car parade, but it's real clear. The only answer that I've found for this kind of thinking is spiritual. And this program is absolute spirituality. Now, what I have seen in this program and what I experienced in me is a bunch of childish spirituality that I had to outgrow. And if you read the family effort, we must be rid of childish spirituality. God wants us to have our head in the clouds with Him, but we must keep our feet firmly planted on the ground. That's where our fellow travelers are, and that's where our work is to be done. How many people have you seen that want to sit over in the corner and pray away every problem? 449 in the big book doesn't work for me. I know exactly what he was talking about. I sit and talk with him. And he still says, Burns, I wouldn't change it because I meant what I meant. And what he meant was right on target. What I've heard in meetings is bastardization of 449. You have to accept somebody came in, rustled my cattle, raped my women, stole my car, set fire to my barn, but I accept it. Give me a friggin' break, would you? You will have to accept it. But I have tried to will acceptance like I tried to will my stopping drinking, like I tried to will serenity. It is a byproduct of a 12-step process. They are lousy goals, and we're all goal-oriented. Please hear me. Don't let somebody sit in the meeting and say, you just have to will acceptance. No, you have to work the steps and acceptance will come. Okay? Spirituality, and for me, spirituality is real clear, humility and responsibility. And I, for those of you who weren't here today, I want to give you my spiritual logarithm. It's a triangle on its point, on a base. It's in perfect balance. This corner, sponsor. This corner, meeting. This corner big book, Trust God, Clean House, Help Others, on a base of honesty and one day at a time. I do talk to my sponsor frequently. I've had three sponsors, and each were given to me by God, and each brought me something special. I do go to meetings. I found out in meetings that this is a perfect program composed of a lot of really imperfect people. And I will guarantee you that if you tie your life into the personalities, you're going to get hurt. It doesn't mean you don't participate, but do not make us... If you want to go with the winners, get a winner. But if you ask us to walk on water, old-timers, we'll tell you we don't walk on water. We've got a lot of experience, and we'll help you with our experience, but don't expect us to walk on water. We're just like you. We've just been doing it a little longer. Honestly, when I went into treatment, I begged to go into treatment, sat in front of the guy running the treatment center, and he said, how much do you drink? And remember I told you I drank in the court. He said, I said, I drink a six-pack of beer every night. He said, you're lying. I said, I know what I do all the time. How do I do that? And it's not just honesty about cash register honesty, but don't minimize cash register honesty. It's real clear for me at 21 years of sobriety, it's just as important I don't lie as it is I'll be honest with myself. The problem with being honest with myself is this alcohol is subtle. The delusional aspect of alcoholism, with me alone, will get me in a lot of trouble. The fifth step is based on God, myself, and another human being. Why? We must be honest with somebody. Because it gets real delusional just in prayer. For me. For me. The only answer is spiritual, and that logarithm will keep your ass out of hot water. It has mine. And you'll learn to use the steps. How to stop your day, how to begin your day. It's all right down there and recorded. First year of my recovery was crazy as hell. Then after about 4 years in recovery, I became Little Mr. AA. Then after 5 years in recovery, I was terrified. I couldn't find my car. And finally, I came to know God who loves me just as I am. Then Casey and I ran into the problem we ran into. I told you about that. And we went into therapy when I was about 14 years sober. And we spent 3 years in therapy working real good programs and brought our marriage back together, because that marriage almost was lost. We were celibate for 4 years. It was not a good time. And we worked through that. Right now, I'm on a particular journey for myself, using the same principles, but I've become increasingly aware of the fact that I have a significant depression. I do not compare my program to anybody, but I wouldn't change it with anybody. And I fought significant depression for a long time. I studied Bill Wilson's life till I feel like I sleep with that man. And he has been my source of great inspiration, because this man had a miserable life. And we know the joy and the courage and the message he brought to many people. Richard told us about it, and I agree with him 100%. But this man was tortured, and so have I. I've been asked to be put on medication 5 years ago. And you heard my lecture today, and there's not many people, and you only heard a part of what I know. I know this stuff backwards and forwards, and I know that some of these medicines are absolutely safe, and I know some people need to take them. But with my history that you've heard, I was terrified to take them. I've reached the point to where my quality of life is significantly impaired currently. I do the addiction work for a men and women's homeless shelter, and I work with drunks all the time. I take care of 400 doctors and love every minute of it. I go to my own meetings and have my own program, and I wouldn't change it with anybody. But life at times, I've sat in the kitchen with my head in my hands with significant frequency over the past year. Casey has cried and begged me to see a doctor, and I have. I'm getting ready to go back into therapy to look at some stuff. It will not change my AA program. Remember one time I gave a talk down in Albany, Georgia, and one of the great gurus in AA. And I said at that time that people were asking me to go into therapy, and he got up on the podium that night and he said, if anybody in AA works the 12 steps and goes to meetings every day, they'll never need therapy. I went up to him and told him the next night that he had so much more sobriety than me and I had so much to learn that maybe one day I would know that what he said was true, but for some reason it didn't make sense to me. Now I'm 21 years sober and he's full of shit. And I told him to his face, and I didn't tell him with resentment. What I told him was, you're hurting people. If you want to say that if you work this program, 92% of people were clear of depression, that's true. If you want to say you work this program and 100% of people were clear of depression, that's false. And unless you know what you're doing, don't talk about it. And I need that to be real clear. 92% will not need medicine. Maybe I won't. But the fact is that the decision is being made as to whether I will take medication. And if I do, I'll take a safe medication. But I may have to, because the quality of my life at this point in time is not what I'm willing to accept. And I know that God has given me, and the Big Book tells me, all sorts of tools to use. And there's no reason for me, out of my fear, to back off from my God and get the help that I need, because God has afforded it to me by very highly trained specialists. I'm sure I won't change any of the rest of my life, but I'm absolutely convinced at this point in time in my life there's only one thing that's absolutely sacred, and that is my sobriety. And that is my sobriety. Nothing else. Nothing else. It means looking at my marriage. It means looking at my traveling and circuit speaking. It means looking at the work that I do at home, putting them into balance so that I can be a part of my family, so that I can be a part of my medical community, and still do what I need for recovery. I hear people say all the time, we never say no. That's horseshit. And I need to say it real loud and clear to you. We never say no is horseshit. We never say no until we talk to our sponsor and our support group to make sure where our thinking is. But I've watched people impale themselves talking on the circuit and sponsoring 50 and 60 people, and watch the quality of their lives go right down the crapper until they get judgmental and start telling everybody else what to do, and they turn into roaring assholes. And I'm only about a half a hair off of it myself, you know. And I need to say that. I'm not really fearful, but I get angry when I realize that some people will judge just what I said right then. Because Wilson wrote in Emotional Sobriety in 1953, he knew that his problem were his dependencies. And he called his dependency on people, places, things, money, power, and prestige. And Wilson had come out of a 10-year huge depression and came up right along with it. And when he was depressed, he gave us some of our greatest literature. And when he came out of it in early 1950s, 1953, he wrote that. It was subsequently published in the Grapevine in 58. And you ought to afford yourself a real luxury and a real necessity is to find that. Bill Wilson's writing in the Grapevine in 58 on emotional sobriety. And he was right on target. He was right on target. And I have danced to that tune of my mama's perfection. I tried to be perfect for mama, and she couldn't handle it. I tried to be perfect for me, and I can't do it. I've tried to be perfect for God, and I'm beginning to find out he doesn't need it. So I'm pretty excited about this phase of my life. I'm pretty excited about it. I have great hopes, and I have great faith. God has always given to me what I've been willing to work for. And if I follow the principles that I've come to know in this program of the 12 steps, it always works. I will close by telling you about my family, my children I've told you about, my brother I've told you about. My mama died in 1978. She died of breast cancer, metastasis, and I was 8 months sober, and I got to visit my mother every weekend, and it was a wonderful, wonderful time. I've always been grateful for that. I went down to see my mama every weekend. I love my mother. Think about her almost every day today. Almost every day. My mama was such a part of me, and I loved her so much. She was a goofy little lady, but she was a neat lady. A neat lady with a heart as big as all outdoors and in so much pain. My daddy was like me. He was male-oriented and female-dominated, and that's exactly what I've been all my life. And when mama died, daddy very quickly remarried, and I'm very grateful. He married a lovely lady who was a friend of the family's. And daddy had some happy times for a while, but mama was tough to live with. Only my daddy could have probably lived with my mama, because he was such a gentle giant. When I made my amends to mama, she handled him fine. I tried to make my amends to daddy, and daddy, because of reasons I can't tell you, wouldn't let me talk to him. He said, "Burns Mac, I don't want to talk about him." My daddy was the type of man who never said much. He just always appeared. When I needed him, he was always there. He never said, I love you. He never hugged me. He just was always there. And I wanted my daddy. And I've done at least 200 fifth steps for those men in that men's homeless shelter. And what I found is every one of them wants a significant male to tell them it's okay. And every alcoholic I've ever worked with wants a significant male, the males, I don't work with females, to tell them it's okay. I just don't. It's best for me. It's best for them. If you learn to relate to your own kind, you can stay sober until you do. You ain't got a shot. Get the tape and listen to that one and play with it for a while. But I wanted my daddy to tell me it was okay, and he couldn't. Finally, my sponsor said, "Quit trying to make your amends. You're just shoving it down his throat," and the book tells us that. Teddy then began to develop Alzheimer's. He forgot who I was. He forgot who my mother was. He forgot who my brother was. And Daddy didn't know anything. Peggy and I had to put him in the nursing home. And I would drive down almost every weekend to the nursing home and all the way. And this was about 14, 15 years sober. And I would, about 13, this was when I was in the middle of this spiritual awakening. And I would drive down there and I'd park the car and I'd say, God, it's 250 miles down to where Daddy lived. And I'd say, God, take away my pain. Take away my pain. Please take away my pain. Park the car, go in and work with Daddy, get in the car and cry all the way back because it never worked. This one particular Sunday, I parked the car and I was sitting in the car. I remember, I'm awakening. And I said, dear God, let me do for my daddy what you want me to do. And I walked in and he was sitting in a wheelchair. I didn't call him Hal because that confused him. I didn't call him Daddy. That confused him. Called him Hal. He thought I was his brother, Uncle Buster. So I walked in the room and I said, Hal, can I help you? He's in a wheelchair. He's too weak to walk. And he said, yeah, would you shave me, Buster? And I shaved Daddy. And I said, Hal, would you like some breakfast? And he said, yeah. And I rolled him out and I fed him because he's too weak to feed himself. About that time, Peggy came in and sat opposite me, and she and I got to talking. And Daddy sat in that wheelchair and watched Peggy and me talking to my stepmother. Mother and I used to talk like that all the time, and Daddy would just sit and watch. He was fascinated watching Mother and me talk. He loved it. Peggy and I were talking. I looked around. I said, Hal, would you like to go out on the porch? He said, I believe I would. I rolled him out there, and Peggy and I got to talking. He's sitting in the wheelchair, and he raises himself up in his chair and looks at me and says, son, today you're just like the little boy your mother and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. 10 seconds later, he didn't know who I was and never recognized me again. We buried him 6 years ago. The miracle of recovery is not that my daddy recognized me. That can happen. The miracle of recovery is not that my daddy recognized me or gave me absolution, if you will. The miracle of recovery is that this self-centered alcoholic sat in that car and said, dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. And my prayer for you and my prayer for me is that in all of our affairs on the rest of this day as a prelude to tomorrow, that we say, dear God, what do you want me to be for that checkout gal at Kroger's, for Casey, for my friends, just for the person in the lunch line with me, or the person at the grocery store, or the person at the filling station. Dear God, let me be for them what you want me to be. I really appreciate you letting me be here. Godspeed. Good night.